When we were young, we often heard admonitions from our parents. If it was a cold or rainy day, mother would say, "Wear your cap," or "Wear your gloves." If it was snowy or muddy weather, perhaps, "Wear your overshoes." I grew up on a farm, and so my father would say, "Check the oil on the tractor before you use it. Better check the radiator fluid, too." Dad was always insistent on checking the fluid levels on the tractors because the failure to do so would ruin the tractor. He never worried about us boys failing to fill up the tractor with gasoline. It didn't take us long to figure out that we didn't want to walk home from the far end of the farm to get a gallon of gas because our tractor ran out of fuel. I recall Dad saying, "Feel free to run the tractor without gasoline, but never run the tractor without the other fluids, oil, water, and brake fluid, and so forth." Of course, the tractor wouldn't operate with gas, so it was Dad's way of emphasizing the importance of checking the tractor fluid levels. When operating certain pieces of farm machinery, Dad would say, "Be sure to check the hydraulic fluid levels." And of course, if we didn't check the hydraulic fluid levels, the tractor was fine, but we just didn't check the hydraulic fluid. And if they were low, the machine might not work properly, and we'd have to come back home from the field and then add the fluid. When doing field work with the tractor, Dad would admonish us boys, and there were four of us. My parents had four boys in 5 years. So there were plenty of us to do farm work, and my dad had plenty of tractors. And he said, "Never turn too short at the end of the field when you're turning around with a piece of equipment. The machine that you're pulling could catch the lugs of the tractor tire and then ride up over the tire and squish you." Well, that admonition really got our attention, especially when we were pulling an implement called a drag. A drag was a piece of ground leveling equipment that smoothed the soil prior to planting. It was had a series of parallel bars, and through those bars, it had metal spikes about 6 inches long that were sticking through these bars, and then there would be a whole series of them, like a railroad spike sticking down into the soil, and you would drag it along behind the tractor, and it would break up the lumps and smooth the soil, prepare it for planting. Well, because this was such a wide implement, if you turned the tractor too short, the cables, the outriding cables that hold it, would ride up on the tire. And those spiked bars, if they caught on the tire, tractor tire, then the whole thing would be riding up. And as a kid, I remember turning around, and there's these big spiked bars ready to come down on me. And of course, you can only imagine then what a horrible death that would ensue, or terrible damages at the minimum, if those spiked bars came crashing down. I know that every farm kid had to go through the experience of the horror of it all, of those of the implement getting hooked on the tractor, because didn't listen quite carefully or take seriously Dad's admonition to be careful on the corners. I was raised around livestock, so we were warned never to approach a horse from the rear or surprise a cow from the side. You see, a horse can kick straight back, whereas a cow can only kick to the side and not particularly straight back. My dad tells the story of his younger brother, my Uncle Wilbert. And as a young man, he was taking care of draft horses on the farm, and as many young men did, he often did not wear a shirt in the summertime. As Uncle Wilbert was leaving the horse stall and walking away from a horse, the horse kicked straight back. He put the imprint of a dirty horse's hoof on my uncle's bare back. Now, had my uncle been another 6 inches closer to the horse, of course, it would have snapped him, given him whiplash, could have broken his back or his neck. Had he been just a little bit farther, it wouldn't have touched him at all. As it were, the imprint of the large horse's hoof imprinted neatly right on his back, enough to give him a sting and a dirty mark. The lesson was clear, and it was spread to all of the family for multiple generations, that be careful of your position regarding a horse, especially when directly behind the horse. Now, our parents did not issue these warnings because they hated us or they wanted to control us. They wanted to warn us because they loved us. They didn't want anything bad to happen to us. They know that if we didn't wear a cap, gloves, or boots in bad weather, we might get sick. They knew if we weren't careful operating farm equipment, we could get hurt or worse. Perhaps you were a teenager when your parents gave you warnings about handing the car keys, like be careful when or be careful if. I know my dad explained the dangers to his sons of driving on ice and snow. And so one must be careful in those circumstances. In the Bible, there's a number of warnings that are issued by our Creator. He mentions these warnings because he loves us. Just like our parents tell us to wear our caps or be careful on the highway, Jesus Christ specifically lists 7 warnings to us during his 3.5-year ministry. I'm entitling this message, The 7 Bewares of Christ. 7 times Jesus Christ uttered the word beware and then followed that with an explanation of what we should be beware of. If it was important enough for our Creator and Messiah to mention, then it surely is critical for us to understand what he was warning us about. The first mention, and I'm going to take them in the order in which they appear in the Bible. The first one is beware of false prophets. We find that in Matthew 7:15. Beware of false prophets. In Matthew 7, chapter 7 and verse 15, beware of false prophets which come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly they're ravening wolves. Now, in other words, there's something to be of concern here when there's a false prophet, somebody who's saying something that's going to happen that isn't true. In Matthew 24, in verse 11, we know that this is not simply an isolated circumstance. There's not just going to be one false prophet. If we look in Matthew 24, in verse 11, we will, and it's talking here about an end-time prophecy that Jesus Christ gave, in Matthew 24, 11, at that time, many will turn away from the faith and will betray and hate each other, and many false prophets will appear and deceive many people. So there are going to be not just one or two or three, but many false prophets, and they will show up. And it doesn't say that, oh, maybe one or two people might get misled by it. It doesn't say that everyone will be deceived, but it does say that many people will be deceived by the false prophets. There is an example of a false prophet that comes shortly after this in the Bible. It's in Acts 13. And this is the story of an encountering with a false prophet of the apostles Paul and Barnabas in Acts 13. And the story is told in verses 1 through 12 of Acts 13. And I may paraphrase as we go through it. But in chapter 13 of verse 1, that Paul and Barnabas went on their way and went on in their travels, and they comes down to verse 6, and they traveled. They were on Cyprus, by the way, in verse 4, and in verse 6, they traveled the whole island, and there they met a Jewish sorcerer and a false prophet named Bar-Jesus. Now, there was a fellow there who was interested in the truth. In other words, you might say he was interested in attending a Kingdom of God seminar. He was a prospect. He was serious. And verse 8, but the sorcerer, Elimas, the sorcerer, for that's what his name means, opposed him and tried to turn the proconsul, the person interested in the truth, from the faith. And so there is a story of how Paul and Barnabas dealt with it. And if we read on down to verse 11, Paul tells him what's going to happen to this false witness. It says, you're going to be blind for a time and not even be able to see the light of the sun. And immediately the mist and darkness came over, meaning over the false prophet. And he groped about seeking someone to lead him by the hand. And that was reinforcing in verse 12. It says, when the proconsul saw what happened, he believed, meaning he believed the truth. He believed the apostles as they explained the plan of God, for he was amazed at the teaching about the eternal. So it's altogether that false prophets will be here and influence our lives from time to time. And, of course, there will be one known as the great false prophet. I'm not going to turn there, but in Revelation 19 and 20, it says there will arise a great false prophet who will deceive many. The question then is what does a false prophet look like? Well, in Matthew 24, verse 4, it talks of, again, with Christ's end-time prophecy. in Matthew 24:24, false messiahs and false prophets will appear and perform great signs and wonders to deceive, if possible, even the elect. So false messiahs and false prophets. Well, it says here they'll be able to perform signs and wonders to deceive, if possible, the elect, which means it could be very difficult to detail who is a false prophet and who is not. And so, therefore, you must ask, as we must each ask the question, is it possible with me? And, of course, this is the ultimate question. Could we possibly be deceived if we are the elect? Could we open ourselves up to be deceived? So Christ is telling us to be mindful, to be wary, to be watchful, and by understanding, to be discerning so that we can determine whether or not there is a false prophet. Now, of course, we've all heard false prophets over the last year that says that we're going to quit keeping the Sabbath, quit keeping the holy days, and we go and start believing the Trinity and a whole long list of other things. And we know that not to be true. But we are to be careful of this. Some are obvious and some are not so obvious. Some are a little more slippery because they will deceive many. And as we have seen, many can be deceived in such a manner. So, number one, Christ's beware warning to us is beware of false prophets. The second point that Christ told us to beware of is to beware of men. This is in Matthew 10, and starts in verse 17. In Matthew 10, in verse 17. I thought this rather odd when Christ made this statement in Matthew 10:17. But beware of men, for they will deliver you up to the councils, and they will scourge you in their synagogues. Well, I found this quite interesting, particularly if you apply this to recent history. But if you are to beware of men, meaning people who aren't doing what they should, they will deliver you up to the councils. In other words, they will make accusations against you and scourge you in their synagogues, means speak evil or to not speak well of someone in a house of God. And so beware that certain people will do that. Doesn't mean they're a false prophet, but they may speak ill of someone or deliver people up to be judged inappropriately. In Matthew 24 and verses 3 and 4. In Matthew 24, verses 3 and 4, as Jesus was sitting on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately. Tell us, they said, when will this happen? And he was speaking then of the end times. When will this happen, and what will be the sign of your coming and the end of this age? And verse 4, Jesus answered, this is in Matthew 24, watch out that no one deceives you, for many, verse 5, will come in my name, claiming I am the Messiah, and will deceive many. So there are many people that will be, that men will make false claims, and will deceive others. In Ephesians 4, continuing this theme of beware of men, Ephesians 4 and verses in verse 11, starting in verse 11, this is where the writer is talking about the gifts and what God has placed into the church. In verse 11, and he himself gave some to be apostles, some prophets, some evangelists, some pastors and teachers. Verse 12, for the equipping of the saints, for the work of the ministry, for the edifying of the body of Christ. Verse 13, till we all come to the unity of the faith and knowledge of the Son of God, to a perfect man, to the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ, that we should no longer be children, tossed to and fro, carried about with every wind of doctrine, by the trickery of men, by the cunning and craftiness of deceitful plotting. So when we beware of men, we should beware of the trickery of men and how we can be susceptible to being tossed about to and fro, like we're in the wind or on the waves, with every wind of doctrine, in that some men will be cunning and crafty and deceitful planning. So we don't want to be misled. Christ is a warning to us here. Ephesians 5 and verse 6 in the next chapter, when we look in Ephesians. In Ephesians 5 and verse 6, Let no one deceive you with empty words, because of these things the wrath of God comes upon the sons of disobedience. What are empty words? I don't know if you've ever thought about that, but empty words are those that do not carry the meanings of God. They carry other meanings. They're empty of the truth. So if we discover that the words are empty, they're not carrying the truth, they will cause the wrath of God. In Colossians, a little further, Colossians 2 and verse 8, in a similar vein, it says, and when Christ said to beware of men, well, there's a little further explanation in Colossians 2 and verse 8. Beware lest anyone cheat you through philosophy and empty deceit, according to the tradition of men, according to the basic principles of the world, and not according to Christ. So, as we heard in our sermonette, sometimes men put forth what they think ought to be so, and then claim that it should be simply because it's their tradition, but it's through philosophy or empty deceit, and not according to Christ. So we must be careful of what men say. In 2 Thessalonians in 2, in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, in verse 3, this is all fitting into point number 2 on the beware of men. In 2 Thessalonians 2 and verse 3, don't let anyone deceive you in any way, for that day will not come until the rebellion occurs and the man of lawlessness is revealed, the man doomed to destruction. He will oppose and exalt himself over everything that is called God or is worshipped, so he sets himself up as God's temple, proclaiming himself to be God. And of course, we're looking at that end time when there is a false prophet, a false witness, and a beast power in that time. But it doesn't say just one. It just says don't let anyone deceive you. In other words, you must be mindful all the way along. Don't just say, well, I only have to worry about this, the very last one that's going to be there, the big false witness or the big false prophet. No, it's don't let anyone deceive you along the way. And if we progress then in 1 John 3, in verse 7, in 1 John 3, dear 7, to emphasize that point about beware of men. In 1 John 3, verse 7, dear children, do not let anyone lead you astray. The one who does what is righteous, is righteous, just as he is righteous. So we must be mindful that we must not be led astray and that we must pattern our lives after what is righteous, what is the right thing to do. Years ago, I had about a dozen employees in a small company, and as often the case in a small business, we had a close-knit group of employees. As usual, on Friday afternoon, at closing, I wished everyone a good weekend, and I closed up the building. We often laughed and joked, kidded around, and one Friday afternoon, I said, well, I will see everyone on Monday, so don't get hit by a train. And it was a lighthearted statement. I didn't really mean anything by it. And after all, everyone watches out for trains, right? On the following Monday, I received a phone call that one of my employees would not be coming to work that day. Over the weekend, she and a group of friends were riding in a large recreational vehicle-type motorhome. The RV was approaching a railroad crossing. The warning lights were flashing. The RV driver thought he could make it across the railroad tracks before the oncoming train. And he was right. The RV did make it across the railroad tracks just in the nick of time. The front of the train engine barely scraped the back of the RV. Unfortunately, the driver of the RV did not take into account that the RV was pulling a boat and a trailer. And the engine of the train struck right between the RV and the boat trailer. The RV then was slammed back against the train on one side of the train engine, and the boat and the trailer were slammed back against the engine of the train on the other side. The RV disintegrated upon impact, and parts of the RV frame were dragged along for the better part of the next mile while the train engineer tried to bring the train to a halt. The propane gas tank on the RV exploded in the crash, complicating the issue and further disintegrating the RV. my employee, the young lady, found herself lying out in a field, along with other hurt people and the debris that was scattered from the shattered recreational vehicle. A baby passenger died in the crash, all because the passenger, the driver, did not heed the warning. It wasn't my employee's fault that the driver chose to try to beat the train to the railroad crossing, yet she suffered greatly because of it. She wasn't deceived by his words, but by his actions. She should have been cautious about who she associated with, because the consequences of those choices can be fatal. So beware of men. Point number two, the reminder is Christ told us, beware of men, whether or not they deliberately mean to do harm. Point number three, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. This is in Matthew 16, in verse 6. Beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. In Matthew 16, in verse 6, and Christ is speaking here when he says, take heed and beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and Sadducees. And moving it on and up to verse 11, Christ says, how is it that you do not understand that I spoke it not to you concerning bread, that you should beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and Sadducees? In other words, it's not just the bread he was talking about during the days of unleavened bread, and this will be expanded on more in 90 days or so, in about 3 months when the days of unleavened bread are coming. But it goes on. One of his disciples later wrote in further explanation as to what was the leaven of the Pharisees in Luke 12 and verse 1. In Luke 12 and verse 1, there's a description as to what is the leaven of the Pharisees. Now, we know from our background in the church and our understanding of leaven is how it puffs up, how it's like yeast. It goes throughout the entire product that you're baking, whether it's bread or cake or cookies or rolls. It's something that causes, you know, the gas bubbles to bubble up inside and puffs up the bread, and it goes throughout the dough. So how could Christ be talking about the leaven of Pharisees in this case? And in Luke 12 and verse 1, the definition is made more clear. In the meantime, when they were gathered together, an innumerable multitude of people, that's a lot, it means nobody there could actually count that high, insomuch as they trod one upon another, in other words, they were right shoulder to shoulder, right next to each other, he began to say to his disciples, first of all, in other words, what was the priority of what he was saying that day? Beware you of the leaven of the Pharisees, which is hypocrisy. According to Merriam-Webster's dictionary, hypocrisy is a feigning to be what one is not, or to believe what one is not, especially the false assumption of the appearance of virtue or religion. Christ had much to say about the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and particularly their hypocrisy, where they claimed to follow God, but they made up their series of their own rules, and then the rules that were for other people to keep instead of themselves. And that lends itself right into the next point. So point three was beware of the leaven of the Pharisees, because, and then as I was going through this subject, and I go to point four, beware the doctrine of the Pharisees and Sadducees. I saw that there's actually 2 points. It wasn't just the leaven of the Pharisees, but the doctrine. So one is the hypocrisy, which is point three. And point four, beware of the doctrine of the Pharisees and Sadducees. And we read that in Matthew 16, in verse 12. In Matthew 16, in verse 12, where Christ uttered the beware. And then they then understood how he bade them not beware of the leaven of bread, but the doctrine of the Pharisees and Sadducees. So when Christ was admonishing them, as he was just a few verses earlier, about the leaven of the Pharisees, what was the problem was the hypocrisy of them, but also the doctrine. So just what was that doctrine? Well, first let's go to Mark 7. in verse 7, because this explains both the hypocrisy and the doctrine of the Pharisees and Sadducees. In Mark 7, in verse 7. In verse 7, "And in vain they worship me, teaching as doctrines the commandments of men." So this is in essence what those Pharisees and Sadducees were doing. They were teaching as if they had authority to pronounce doctrine. They weren't going to the Bible for doctrine as much as they were creating their own doctrine, whether it was, as we heard about in the sermonette, whether it was about the Trinity or the purgatory or rapture. Now, that wasn't the issue of the day when the Pharisees and Sadducees, as it is today, but they were creating their own commands about what they should do. And we can read more about what they were doing and how they were doing it. And as we, in Colossians 2:8, and I think we may have already turned to that one, "Beware lest anyone cheat you through philosophy and empty deceit, according to the tradition of men, according to the basic principles of the world, and not according to Christ." In other words, people would cheat you by giving you false doctrine and therefore deceive you. If we go just a few verses more in Colossians 2, down to verse 20, this gives us, spells it out just a little more clearly about what the problem was at the time, the problem at hand. In Colossians 2:20, breaking into the thought, "Why do you follow the old ways of worship? Why do you obey man-made rules?" I'm reading this in the New International because it's a little smoother, I think, in the reading. Verse 21, "These rules say, you must not put your hand on this." Quote, do not put this into your mouth. You must not put your finger on that. Verse 22, "All these things come to an end when they are used." In other words, they're very physical. "You are following only man-made rules." Verse 23, "It looks as if it is wise to follow these rules in an act of worship because they're hard on the body. It looks as if they're done without pride, but they're worth nothing. They do not take away a man's desire to sin." So what the Pharisees and Sadducees were doing was making up rules that were unhelpful to people and teaching them as if they were doctrines of God. During the winter, especially in the northern states, it can get cold enough for ponds and lakes to freeze, forming a layer of ice on top of the water. There may be signs at public access points warning thin ice. Or the radio announcer will say on the radio that people should not attempt to walk on the frozen ponds or on the lakes. Sometimes it happens here when it gets cold that way. Because looks can be deceived, or can be deceptive. The ice might not be thick enough to carry a person's body weight, and he or she can break through the thin ice and drown. Sometimes people do not heed the warning and they go onto the frozen lakes and ponds anyway. My grandfather or grandmother's cousin in Minnesota was an avid fisherman. He would be on the lake fishing at every opportunity he could year round. In the winter, he would go ice fishing. He would build a small plywood enclosure about 4 feet by 4 feet square and about 6 feet tall. And he would drag that or place it on the ice of a frozen lake. And inside this tiny temporary shelter, he would cut about a 12 or 16-inch hole in the ice with an ice drill or an ice saw. And then he would drop a fishing line in the hole, usually put a little card table or a little something over the top of it. And he and his buddies would sit in there, and they would play cards and drink their favorite adult beverages while they're waiting for the fish to bite. And often the ice was thick enough that people could drive their cars out onto the lake or their pickup trucks, and entire fishing villages could form out on a windswept, frozen lake. Now, the lake, the ice would be, we say it may be 6 inches deep, it may be a foot deep, but it wouldn't, when you drive out on it, it wouldn't sink as you might think, because it's like a skin on top of the lake and the water pressure holds up the ice. So as long as the ice is thick enough, everything will be fine. Well, at some point, the winter gives way to spring, and then the ice tends to melt, and the ice becomes thin, and it's no longer safe to drive on the lake. Well, my grandmother's cousin, being the avid fisherman that he was, as were all the relatives, he kept his fishing up until the last possible day. He just had to be there every day. Now, even beyond when it was really safe, I was just a lad when I heard what happened to him. He was a large man. He walked with two canes because his knees were bad, and as a youngster, I never saw him without one cane in each hand, so he would walk along with two canes. He was driving on the frozen lake, going out to his fish house, and the four wheels of his car broke through the ice. Well, momentarily, the weight of the body of the car settled to the ice because it had only broken through where the tires were, four different places. Now, those who go fishing know that it takes a few seconds, and then the car sinks low enough in the water. In other words, the car is dropping through it, making a rectangular hole in the ice, but you've got a few seconds. And the driver can get his door open, or the driver and passengers, if they can get their doors open in time, then that'll give them a longer period of time to get out of the car, and they'll be safe. So if you feel it cracking, everybody should open their car doors. I mean, that's people in cold country. They know if they're going to drive on a lake, they know these rules. Well, if you don't, then as the car sinks down into the ice, you can no longer open the car door, and you will watch yourself go down. Well, my grandmother's cousin tried to open his car door, but it was too late. He couldn't open his car door to escape the sinking car because the car had already sunk a little bit too deep in the water. The bottom of the door was below the line of the ice. Now, despite his car breaking through the ice, and despite that he was a large man with two bad knees, he managed to roll down his mechanical window and crawl out of that small window onto the ice next to a sinking car, out in the middle of a lake. His car continued to go down to the bottom of the lake, went through the rectangular hole, through the frozen lake, leaving him sprawled out on the ice in the middle of this lake, unable to walk, flopping like a hurt walrus. Now, no one else dared drive their car out to the lake to rescue him, but some folks did manage to walk out on the ice and drag him to safety using a sled. I was just a lad at the time, but the lesson was clear to everyone in our extended family. Take heed about the thin ice. The ice may look secure, but you may have driven on that ice before, but it may not be safe. From time to time, we have to ask ourselves if we're on spiritual thin ice. At first glance, we might think everything looks normal. Just like you can't tell, looking, if a frozen lake is safe to drive on, it's our individual responsibility to check the thickness of our spiritual ice. We must each know in our minds and hearts that we are secure in the knowledge of God and what God expects of us. A year or so ago, many people simply took other people's word for it that the spiritual ice was just fine before they wandered off onto thin ice. Do we take someone else's word for it, that the ice that we're on is thick enough that will bear our weight? Our eternal life depends on our discernment. Are we abiding by the doctrines of God or the commandments of men? If we can turn to Acts 17 in verse 11. Actually, we'll start in Acts 17 in verse 10. In Acts 17, Acts 17, I really want to read verse 11, but it's referred to in verse 10 to explain what was going on at this point. And Paul and Silas left Thessalonica, and they went to Berea. So in verse 11, it talks about the people in Berea. In verse 11, these were more noble than those in Thessalonica, in that they received the word with all readiness of mind and searched the scriptures daily, whether these things be so. Well, the Bereans searched the scriptures daily. They weren't allowing themselves to be misled like the people in Thessalonica. Quite simply, the Bereans were checking the thickness of their spiritual ice. Quite simply, trust your Bible. Don't place your trust in those who would take the place of the Pharisees or Sadducees. For as we read in Mark 7:7, the commandments of men are not the doctrines of God. and we are responsible for making sure that we have checked the details. So the reminder of point four, Christ warned us, beware the doctrine of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. The fifth point, beware of the leaven of Herod. Now, I found this one a bit puzzling. Beware of the leaven of Herod. I thought, this is certainly odd. I mean, why is this in the Bible? How could this fit in here? And that, to read about that, we go to Mark 8 in verse 15. In Mark 8 in verse 15. And Christ is speaking, and he charged them, saying, take heed, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and of the leaven of Herod. There's two references in the Bible to King Herod. The first one is early in Matthew. I think it's in Matthew 2, about the time when Christ was a baby. Jesus Christ was an infant, and Herod was determined to preserve his power by seeking to kill all of the children that were under 2 years of age. And we can read about that. Where is that? In Matthew 2 or so. And I'm not going to turn there. But in Matthew, the story in Matthew 2, in verse 1, the days of Herod and so forth, and the wise men came, and they were searching for the Christ child, and King Herod got a little nervous, so he killed every baby under 2 years of age just to make sure that there wouldn't be a threat to his power base. And I found precious little about the leaven of Herod. But it occurred to me, and there is another reference, and we're going to turn to Matthew 14 here in a moment and start in verse 1, that what was Herod afraid of? Herod was afraid of losing his power, losing his position. Now, in the Roman Empire, under which King Herod served as the king of Judea, the Roman way was to allow a local ruler to stay in charge. And the Roman army and the Roman generals would be in overall charge of the country or of the region, and they would make sure the taxes were collected. But the local king or the local ruler of some sort would be in charge of all the petty crime and the local administration of justice. The Roman Empire didn't get bogged down in the local details. They only dealt with the big ticket issues, like paying your taxes, and don't let people have an uprising against Rome. But they didn't get bogged down in local administration. That was left to King Herod, who was the king over Judea. So that had to be a pretty heady position. Imagine if any of us were somehow selected, the lightning bolt came and hit us and said, Mr. Barron, you are now the king of Northwest Arkansas. The governor has made you in charge of this area, and so you take care of all those things that I don't want to have to deal with. So from now on, that's yours, and whatever it is, the Roman army will likely back you up. So it's likely a very heady position, something that you wouldn't want somebody else to take your place. So he was willing to kill, as we could read in Matthew 2, willing to kill many children in order to prevent somebody from rising up to take his place. Now let's go to Matthew 14 and read just a little bit more about Herod and his concerns. In Matthew 14, and starting in verse 1, and at that time Herod, the tetrarch, or the ruler, heard the reports about Jesus and said to his attendants, this is, or must be, John the Baptist, who has risen from the dead. This is why miraculous powers are at work in him. Now, in verse 3, now Herod had arrested John, meaning John the Baptist, and bound him and had put him in prison because of Herodias, his brother Philip's wife. For John had been saying to him, it's not lawful for you to have her. Verse 5, Herod wanted to kill John, but was afraid of the people because they considered John a prophet. And then on verse 6, through 12, it talks about Herod's niece and then stepdaughter did a dance, and he promised he would give her whatever she wanted, and she wanted the head of John the Baptist. and the king was then grudgingly committed to carrying out this deed and had John the Baptist beheaded. And so that's why he was knew that if there was somebody very popular, he thought it was a resurrected John the Baptist, because he knew right before him. He had seen the head. He had had him beheaded and so forth. He was attempting to preserve his power. So Herod, at this point, as best as we can determine, was attempting to preserve his power, just as we see in many other political environments before Herod and since Herod, where people will attempt to preserve their power and all of those around them will try to keep the status quo or that power structure in place. And it becomes like a leaven. In other words, well, it's like a set of dominoes. Well, if he goes down, well, then I lose my job, and then so-and-so loses their job, and then so-and-so loses their job. And so everybody supports the power structure that is so that it doesn't upset the apple cart, as it were. So reminder five of point five, Jesus Christ said, beware of the leaven of Herod. On to the sixth point, beware of the scribes. In Mark 12 and verse 38, Mark 12, verse 38, Jesus Christ issued his sixth beware. And he said to them in his doctrine, beware of the scribes, which love to go in long clothing and love salutations in the marketplace. Now, this was also written about in a parallel gospel in Luke 20 in verse 46. So we can read it in Mark 12, verse 38. It's expanded on slightly in Luke 20, verse 46. Beware of the scribes which desire to walk in long robes and love greetings in the markets and the highest seats in the synagogues and the chief rooms at feasts. Well, the scribes enjoyed their position, and they wore the appropriate clothing so that everyone would know exactly what their position was. And they had the long clothing. They wore special robes. They had and somebody will come up with the word, the little things that hang off the edges of them, and the fringes and such. And so it was obvious who they were, and they liked it to be obvious as to who they were. And they loved greetings in the markets. In other words, they had their own method of greeting, whether it's each other or insisting on how other people would greet them. And after a while, if somebody started calling you Your Excellency, I presume that you would get to be, you'd really be liking that if people started treating you that way. That's a human characteristic. And so the scribes particularly liked those pleasant greetings. And interestingly enough, the highest seats in the synagogue, they sat where everybody could see them when you're sitting up high, and the chief rooms at the feast. In other words, they liked the positions of honor. So beware of the scribes. Now, what did Christ had something to say about the scribes, and we've talked here so far about scribes and Pharisees and Sadducees. And I want to read just a few verses here of exactly what Christ thought of this kind of behavior. And it's up to us to translate this kind of behavior into the world around us today. Because the Bible is preserved not just as a record of history, but how we can use it as we take a look and make decisions about the world around us. So in Matthew 23, if you can follow along with me, we're going to go through what Christ said very specifically of how he felt about such things. And he was very clear in Matthew 23, and we're going to start in verse 13. We're going to hop through it. We're not going to take every verse. In Matthew 23, in verse 13, but woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! Did we not read that earlier where it was said very clearly that the leaven of the Pharisees, it was hypocrisy? Continuing on, for you shut up the kingdom of heaven against men, for neither go in yourselves, nor do you allow those who are entering to go in. In other words, they put obstacles in their way so that people could not get God's truth. Verse 14, woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites. It's repeated. For you devour widows' houses and for a pretense make long prayers that you will, therefore you will receive greater condemnation. Verse 15, woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites. For you travel land and sea to win one proselyte, and when he is won, you make him twice as much a son of hell as yourselves. In other words, they forced this person to do all of these extra things that we were reading about, all these commandments of men, instead of the expectations of God. Verse 23, let's move down. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites. Do we see a pattern here, what Christ thinks of these? These are Christ's words. This is the one who created them, knows their nature. He knows them better than anyone else. In verse 23, for you pay tithe of mint and anise and cumin and have neglected the weightier matters of the law, justice, mercy, and faith. These you ought to have done without leaving the others undone. Then look what he calls them in verse 24, blind guides who strain at a gnat and swallow a camel. Now, the whole concept of a blind guide is a bit challenging. I've never seen one in physical life. Unfortunately, I think we've all seen them in our spiritual lives. If we're discerning, we've seen people that were blind that were attempting to lead. And then swallowing or strain at a gnat. In other words, they couldn't stomach some of the smallest little things that were a problem and then swallow a camel. Now, I know there's a lot of size difference, folks. I was up at the Gentry Zoo, and I've seen gnats and I've seen camels in the same place, in the same pen. And there's a lot of difference. Verse 25, woe to you, scribes, Pharisees, hypocrites, for you cleanse the outside of the cup and the dish, but inside they are full of extortion and self-indulgence. Ooh. In other words, the outside looks good, but what's really on the inside? And this is what Christ is speaking about. It's not how pretty the outside of the cup and the dish are. Can you imagine if you had a dishwasher that only washed the outside of your dishes and left the insides, however they were when you last used them, and then tomorrow the same thing, and then the week after, and the month after, and the year after? Not a particularly pleasant thought, and yet Christ was calling it exactly that, that this was an ongoing problem. Verse 26, blind Pharisee. This is repeated again. He called them a blind guide. Now it's blind Pharisee. First cleanse the inside of the cup and the dish, that the outside of them may be clean also. Can you imagine cleaning the outside of a cup or a dish without, or the inside, without having some cleaning effect on the outside? Very difficult to do. Verse 27, woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites. I think that's about the sixth or seventh time in a row he said that altogether. For you are like whitewashed tombs, which indeed appear beautiful outwardly, but the inside are full of dead men's bones and all uncleanness. So it's not just the flatware and the plates and the cups and this and so forth. But now he's talking about tombs that are whitewashed. In other words, they take a lime mixture and they spray it over the stone so it's all pretty. When I was a lad, we would always whitewash the dairy barn. In fact, it was a requirement for either grade B or grade A milk that you had to whitewash everything in the building because you need to know it was very clean. It was as clean a surface as you could get, and they would whitewash it so that you could see if there was any problem or anything that would... any dirt or impurity that would come afterwards. But in this case, all they were doing was whitewashing the outside, and the inside, interestingly enough, was dead men's bones. In other words, they didn't have potential. It wasn't what Christ expected of them. He expected them to be doing what he said. And it says, and all uncleanness. Now, it looked clean on the outside. Looks clean. It's all nice and white and pretty. But he's talking about them, that they were unclean. And verse 28, even so you outwardly appear righteous to men, but inside you are full of, one more time, hypocrisy and lawlessness. Yet these were the same people that insisted on every detail of the law be kept. And Christ is calling them what? Hypocrites and lawless. In other words, they were not keeping his law. They were keeping the commandments of men. Now we go to verse 29. Once again, woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, because you build the tombs of the prophets and adorn the monuments of the righteous, and say, verse 30, if we'd have lived in the days of our fathers, we would not have been partakers with them in the blood of the prophets. In other words, that's part of the reason they were hypocrites. They were claiming they would never do something like that. And brethren, I hope none of us ever gets into that situation where we think that we're above being being possible, that we could be deceived like that. And that's why Christ is telling us to not be deceived, not deceive ourselves thinking we could never be like that. We're so righteous or we're so good. No, we're working on it. And we all need to be working on that. Verse 31, therefore, you are witnesses against yourselves that you are the son of those who murdered the prophets. Because after all, the ones who murdered the prophets thought they were pretty righteous themselves. Verse 32, fill up then the measure of your father's guilt. Serpents, brood of vipers, how can you escape the condemnation of the grave? Verse 34, therefore, indeed, I send you prophets, wise men, and scribes. Some of them you will kill and crucify. Some of them you will scourge in your synagogues and persecute from city to city, that all may come on, that on you may come all the righteous blood shed on the earth, from the blood of the righteous Abel to the blood of Zechariah, son of Berechiah, whom you murdered between the temple and the altar. Interestingly enough, Abel to Zechariah is from A to Z, and that probably is where we get the term today, from A to Z. Or was used in that time. Assuredly, I say to you, all these things will come upon this generation. And since we are reading it, this applies to our generation as well, not just to the generation that Jesus Christ was speaking to at that time. So, reminder of point number 6, Jesus Christ said, beware of the scribes. The seventh beware is beware of covetousness. Beware of covetousness. Now, I thought this was an odd one. We read that in Luke 12, verse 15. In Luke 12 and verse 15, I mean, I didn't see how it would fit into this group. In Luke 12, 15, and he said to them, meaning Christ, take heed and beware of covetousness, for a man's life consists not in the abundance of things which he possesses. We've probably all seen a sign that says, beware of dog. Well, what's the first thing that comes to mind? A big, mean dog that will bite or maul you, right? And most of us have a vicious dog story where we were attacked or threatened by a dog. I know I've got a couple of them. And I know that automotive junkyards, they often have one or more guard dogs in case someone comes into the junkyard at night and attempts to steal auto parts. So even if you don't see the dog, if the sign says, beware of dog, then you have reason to be concerned that there might be a dog lurking around ready to pounce. It's probably not a good idea to hang around an automobile junkyard after the business is closed for the day. Now, I have seen a sign at a junkyard that says, don't worry about the vicious dog. Instead, worry about the owner, Smith & Wesson. Well, the message is clear. Don't trespass or there will be unpleasant consequences, or take your pick, the vicious dog or the angry owner with a gun, or both. Telling us to covet ought to be redundant. It's one of the Ten Commandments that we read in Exodus 20 and Deuteronomy 5. However, Christ taught his disciples and apostles more about the meaning of covetousness. My first thought, we were singing the By the Waters of Babylon, and of course the reason that the children of Israel were carried captive off to Babylon was because of idolatry. Well, let's take a look in Colossians 3, verse 5, and we'll read about that relationship between covetousness and idolatry. In Colossians 3, in verse 5, and I'm reading today out of the King James, the New King James, and the NIV, and this particular verse is the NIV. In Colossians 3, verse 5, put to death, therefore, whatever belongs to your earthly nature, sexual immorality, impurity, lust, evil desires, greed, and greed, which is idolatry. In other words, if you want all of those things of an earthly nature, that becomes idolatry. An example of this is in 1 Samuel 15, in verses starting in verse 14. And this is the time when King Saul was approached by Samuel after Saul had been victorious in battle. In 1 Samuel in chapter 15 and verse 14. And we'll go through the narrative here, and I'll paraphrase it or skip through it. In verse 14, when Samuel reached him, Saul said, "The Lord bless you, I've carried out the Lord's instructions." So in other words, Saul is saying, look, I've done what I'm supposed to do. And Saul said, "But what is the bleating of sheep in my ears? What is this lowing of cattle that I hear?" And Saul answered, verse 15, "The soldiers brought them from the Amalekites. They spared the best of the sheep and cattle to sacrifice to the Lord your God, but we totally destroyed the rest." Well, God told him beforehand to destroy everything. But King Saul is saying, well, the soldiers, they kept the best, and they destroyed everything, so you should be proud, right? Verse 16, "Enough," Samuel said to Saul, "let me tell you what the Lord said to me last night." And Saul replied, "Well, tell me." Verse 17, and Samuel said, "Although you were once small in your own eyes, and you did you not become the head of the tribes of Israel, and the Lord anointed you king over Israel, and he sent you on a mission saying, go and completely destroy those wicked people, the Amalekites, wage war against them until you've wiped them out. Why did you not obey the Eternal? Why did you pounce on the plunder and do evil in the sight of the Lord?" Now, notice the justification that King Saul gave in verse 20. "But I did obey the Eternal," said Saul. "I went on the mission and the Lord assigned me. I completely destroyed the Amalekites and brought back Agag, their king. And the soldiers took sheep and cattle from the plunder, the best of which was devoted to God, in order to sacrifice them to the Lord your God at Gilgal." In other words, he was offering his excuse here. And verse 22, "But Samuel replied, does the Lord delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as much as in obeying the Eternal? To obey is better than sacrifice. To heed is better than the fat of rams." Now verse 23, "For rebellion is like the sin of divination, and arrogance like the evil of idolatry. Because you've rejected the word of the Eternal, he has rejected you as king." So now we can connect the dots. Covetousness, we've read, is idolatry. Idolatry is like arrogance, which is like rebellion. The penalty for Saul, King Saul, was heavy. He lost his kingship. Well, what does that have to do with our ability or our future kingship? Let's take a look in Galatians, and we can read what the effect is upon the rest of us, because after all, we're not all kings of Israel as King Saul was. But what will happen to those who do as King Saul did? In Galatians 5 and verse 19. In Galatians 5 and verse 19. "The acts of the flesh are obvious: sexual immorality, impurity and debauchery," verse 20, "idolatry and witchcraft, hatred, discord, jealousy, fits of rage, selfish ambition, dissensions, factions, and envy, drunkenness, orgies, and the like. I warn you, as I did before, that those who live like this will not inherit the kingdom of God." What did God say to Saul? The kingdom was removed from him because of coveting, because of idolatry, because of his covetousness. He took the things that he should not have taken. He wished to have them. And God equates this idolatry, this covetousness, with all of these other things, with sexual immorality, impurity, debauchery, idolatry, witchcraft, hatred, discord, jealousy. Have we ever seen any of those things before? Selfish ambition, dissensions, and factions. All of those things are in the same category. God doesn't differentiate them. He puts them all right there and says, any one of those things will keep you from inheriting the kingdom of God. Now, covetousness or idolatry is very tempting. It certainly was tempting to King Saul. If we look in 1 Corinthians 10, in 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 13. In 1 Corinthians 10, verse 13, "No temptation has overtaken you except what is common to mankind, and God is faithful. He will not let you be tempted beyond what you can bear. But when you're tempted, he will also provide a way out so that you can endure it." Now, and we've heard that verse many a time, but now let's look at the very next verse. It's a short one. 14, "Therefore," in other words, in conclusion, because of, let's wrap it up, let's sum it up. "Therefore, my dear friends, flee from idolatry." What is idolatry? Christ said to beware of covetousness, which is idolatry, and it's very tempting. So covetousness can mean more than desiring someone else's earthly possessions. One can also desire someone else's power and prestige. You can covet someone else's reputation. This can lead to attempts to destroy another person's reputation. Christ and his apostles said to avoid such temptations, or we're in danger of not being in part of God's kingdom. So point seven is a reminder that God told us the seventh saying of Christ. Jesus Christ said, beware of covetousness. Are the warnings issued by Jesus Christ any less important than the warnings issued about icy roads, avoiding vicious dogs, flashing railroad crossing lights, reports of thin ice on ponds, not wearing our gloves or caps in cold weather, running out of gas, or ignoring the car's warning lights for low oil or a high radiator fluid temp, or the warning about kicking horses or wearing overshoes in the mud or operating heavy machinery? The warnings all exist for our benefit. But even more than the physical warnings are the warnings for the spiritual warnings, the seven bewares of Christ. And I'll run through them now. Number one, beware of false prophets. Number two, beware of men. Number three, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. Number four, beware of the doctrine of the Pharisees and Sadducees. Number five, beware of the leaven of Herod. Number six, beware of the scribes. And number seven, beware of covetousness. Seven times Christ ordered the word beware, and then followed that with an explanation of what we should be aware of. If it was important enough for our Creator and Messiah to mention, then surely it is critical enough for us to understand what he was talking about. Just as a sign warning us of a danger of walking on thin ice, so we should be mindful of the bewares uttered by Jesus Christ. Mr. Jackson.